Great. So our speaker today is Joel Fine, and he'll be telling us about knots, minimal surfaces, J holomorphic curves. So please take it away.
Thanks for the introduction, and thanks very much for the invitation. And unfortunately, I have to start with a bit of an apology. I hope I haven't got you all here under false advertising. So my abstract claimed I could count minimal surfaces of all genus. And in the last few days, I've discovered a bug in the proof, which I'll explain, which means that the proof works perfectly when the minimal surface is a disk, but awkward things can happen when the genus is higher than, well, when the surface can develop nodes. Anyway, I'll explain what happens. I'll explain why it shouldn't morally be a problem, but it is actually technically, it does seem to be a problem. And I'm working hard to fix the bug. But anyway, let me tell you things that are true. So almost everything I'm going to explain today is due to me, but there's also some important parts that are due to my PhD student, Tienen Geyen. So I wanted to say his name as well at the beginning. And let me give you an overview of the talk. So let me give you, first of all, a vague formulation of the main theorem as it stands now. So take a knot in the three sphere. And I want to think of the three sphere as the boundary at infinity of hyperbolic four space. Okay. So this knot, you can ask, how many minimal disks does it bound? So how many minimal disks are there in H4 whose ideal boundary runs out to infinity to give you K? And the theorem says that this number is a knot invariant. So it doesn't change when you make an isotopy of K. So the first thing I want to say is, when knot theorists see disks bounding knots, they think of slice genus, and these disks needn't be embedded. They needn't even be smooth, you see, because they're like minimal surfaces. They could have the same singularities that complex curves can have in C2. Okay, so you shouldn't think that just because your slice genus isn't zero, that your knot doesn't bound any minimal disks. It might well do. Okay. And the first conjecture is that it should be possible to count these connected minimal surfaces of arbitrary genus. And that's what I thought I'd managed to do, but there's a slight bug in the proof that I'll explain. So it should be possible to count minimal surfaces with arbitrary genus and lots of boundary components. And that way you'd get a sequence of invariants of links, okay, counting these minimal surfaces. And so this sequence of invariants is parameterized by the genus, but there's also another topological invariant, which looks a bit like a degree somehow, where it sees how the surface sits inside H4. So it's topological again. And so morally, you should have a pair of integers parameterizing these invariants. So now it begins to look like perhaps the coefficients of a polynomial. So the second, much more speculative conjecture is that it should lead to some known two-variable knot polynomial or link polynomial, for example, Homfly PT, maybe. Okay, so that's where I'd like this project to go. I thought I'd done A, and I was working on B when I realized there was a mistake in the proof of A. Okay, so why would it be really exciting for B to be true? So if you were a minimal surface theorist, finding minimal surfaces is really tough because you have to solve a PDE, and solving PDEs isn't something that comes easily. But if it turned out that the solutions were counted by Homfly PT, then you could just draw a picture of your knot, compute it using whatever technique it is you use for computing Homfly, and this combinatorial calculation would then prove the existence of lots of minimal surfaces, you see, and it would tell you their genus and their degree, hopefully, or at least some relationships between them. If you're a knot theorist, then this should be really exciting because you can sell your knot theory to minimal surface people. And in the background of all of this, there's actually J holomorphic curves. So these minimal surface invariants that these counts, they're actually a type of Gromov-Witten invariant. But the J holomorphic curves have a very strange boundary condition. So if you're into symplectic geometry and J holomorphic curves, then perhaps the takeaway from this talk is that there's a new type of infinite volume symplectic manifold, which has an interesting singularity as you run to infinity that enables you to define knot invariants. So I don't know if I have time to talk about that or not. Okay, so the paper as it appears on archive has my mistake in it. It's in section 5, for those, I'm sure all of you read the paper from front to back before this talk in preparation. If you didn't spot the mistake, then more fool you. But the technical heart of the paper is sections 3 and 4, and all of that's correct. I'm just too naive the way I put it together. So here's the notation. So N0 of K, that's the number of minimal disks filling K, where you need to suitably interpret number, okay, in the same way as Gromov-Whitman invariants work. And that's well defined. And then if L is a link and G is a general genus, then this isn't quite well defined yet, but hopefully it will be one day soon. And that's the number of connected minimal surfaces of genus G filling L. And the obvious question is, can we compute this invariant? And given what I've already just said, the answer's almost certainly no, because I haven't proved it's equivalent to Homfly or anything like that yet. But there are two situations in which we know all the answers. So if you look at the unknot, you can count the minimal disks filling the unknot. You just take S3, take an equatorial circle, and there's a unique minimal surface that fills that equatorial circle. It's the totally geodesic copy of H2. So that tells you that the genus zero invariant is 1, and all the other genus invariants are 0. You see? Okay, so a consequence of the well-definedness of N0 is that if you take any version of the unknot, so now instead of taking the equator, I take some horribly wiggly unknot like this, it will also fill a minimal disk, also be filled by a minimal disk in H4. And the other calculation that we do know is, so even though this invariant isn't quite well-defined, I'll explain why this is true. So all of the invariants for split links vanish. And what this means is, if you have a split link, there's a way of arranging it in such a way in S3 such that there's no connected minimal surface that fills it. And that's what Teen, my PhD student, proved. So assuming this is well defined, then it must vanish for all G. So if you're thinking about properties of Homfly, when you take split links, depending on the conventions you use for normalizing Homfly, you might want things to be multiplicative, and then this sort of theorem becomes very important. So I conjectured this was true. I couldn't prove it. I explained it to Teen, and the very next day he came back to my office with the proof. I was quite surprised. He's a clever kid. Okay, so what's this got to do with geomorphic curves? So if you take H4, it turns out there's a special, almost complex structure on a 6 manifold, which topologically is just the product of H4 with S2. It's the twister space of H4. So the almost complex structure J is definitely not a product. Okay, but topologically that's all that's going on. And this almost complex structure that was found by Eales and Salomon has the property that if you look at minimal surfaces in H4, they're in one-to-one correspondence with geomorphic curves in Z. So if you take a geomorphic curve in Z and project it down to H4, going this way, it just becomes a minimal surface. And to go back the other way is a kind of Gauss map. So you can think of this a little bit like two planes in the tangent bundle. It's not quite two planes in the tangent bundle is S2 cross S2. Two planes in R4 is S2 cross S2. And if you project down onto one of the S2s, you get the twister space. So there's a component of the Gauss map. So if I take a minimal surface in H4, its Gauss map is holomorphic into twister space. So it's a bit like Weierstrass representation for minimal surfaces in R3, if you've seen that before. But don't worry if this doesn't mean anything. I'll explain in a little bit more detail later. And so this count of minimal surfaces filling knots is a kind of Gromov-Whitman invariant. You see, I'm counting geomorphic curves in this Z. But there are big differences between what we're doing here and standard Gromov-Whitman theory. And the reason is that this J becomes horribly singular as you run to the boundary of H4, because the metric of H4 has like a double pole. If you think of the hyperbolic metric as dx squared plus dy squared over y squared, it blows up as you run to the boundary. And that has implications for this J, which also blows up as you run to the boundary. See? And that's why you can look at geomorphic curves in this guy whose boundary projects to a knot in the 3 sphere. So it's completely atypical. Normally, geomorphic curves, the boundary conditions should be Lagrangians. Right, but we don't have that here. We have something seemingly more constrained. But it's okay, it works out, the Fredholm theory all works out because precisely of the singularity of this J. And it turns out that both these points of view are essential in proving the result. So you need to know that the geolomorphic curves project to minimal surfaces to prove the compactness theorems. And you need to know that the minimal surfaces lift the geolomorphic curves to have a hope of proving the invariance. Okay, so that was an overview of everything that I'm going to say. And here's like a list of contents. So I'm going to, yes.
Maybe this is too early to ask a question or a comment. Can you go back a little bit up?
Sure.
I just have a comment. So, I mean, the first one is that, let me see. So you personally know this, but this kind of problem of finding like minimal surfaces with fixed boundary conditions at the boundary of H4 and S2, it's kind of useful when you study Wilson loops in gauge theories in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence.
I have definitely seen all of the words that you've just said, but I'm a mathematician with very little understanding of.
Yeah, so now something mathematical. I mean, so the minimal surface equations essentially is just saying that you want to that you want to solve some equations of motion that define the area of the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Now the right hand side, usually there's a version of the right hand side that the right setup would be to find what are called the supersymmetric embedding surfaces. You're going to have surfaces, you have a theory that has a certain amount of supersymmetry, and you want to demand that the surfaces preserve a subset of the supersymmetries. And I think that what I'm a bit confused about here is that in general, there is no one-to-one correspondence between these things. So the set of supersymmetric solutions is larger generically than the space of minimal surfaces.
So, by supersymmetric solutions, do you mean these geolomorphic curves?
Yes.
So the when I write one-to-one, there is one particular family of geolomorphic curves, which we're not seeing here as minimal surfaces, and those are the fibers, the twister fibers. They all project down to points. But otherwise, this is completely true. This is a true statement for any Riemannian-oriented Riemannian four-manifold.
This seems to contradict with things I know, but maybe. So don't you have to put some boundary condition on S2? So the way physicists do this is that you take hyperbolic space and you put the boundary at, say, z equals epsilon, where your boundary, where the metric blows up, is z equals zero.
Mm-hmm.
You call some kind of Dirichlet boundary condition along S2. You have to tell me what the surface does also on S2. What is your boundary condition on S2?
I don't have one. So this statement is purely local. That's if you take a small piece of a minimal surface inside H4, its Gauss map is a geolomorphic curve in Z. Similarly, if you take a small piece of geolomorphic curve in Z, unless it's actually part of a vertical twister line, then when you project it down to H4, it'll be a minimal surface. That's all I meant by this correspondence.
But I thought you were going to impose boundary conditions at some point.
Right, I will. So when I count these things, what I want to count are the minimal surfaces whose ideal boundary is a fixed knot.
Yeah, but I think, at least from the physics point of view, you also have to specify what happens on the sphere. As you go around that, imagine one thing you could do is that as you go around the unknot, you could also be rotating on the circle on the sphere, for example.
Right, but I think I've understood. So if I give you a loop inside the three sphere, over the boundary, the twister space looks like this, okay?
Okay.
And this S2 is the unit tangent bundle of this S3. So now if I have a knot in S3, it lifts automatically to S2, and that's the lift I use to count the geolomorphic curves. Does that answer your question?
Not particularly, no. Maybe Kevin can translate.
He's saying that given a knot in S3, it has a canonically defined lift to a knot in S3 times S2.
That's right.
Right, the point in S2 is just like the direction the knot is pointing.
Think of your knot in R3 instead of S3. Then there's an obvious way to lift your knot to this product. You take the knot in R3, and then you lift it to the point where the factor in S2 is so just the tangent.
That at the boundary, you pick a point on the two sphere.
It's given to you by the knot itself. It's just the direction in which the knot is oriented.
I don't object to that, but So this looks like. I mean, if I understand correctly, this is precisely what you would do if you study like the most basic Wilson loop. What you do is you know, in that language, you have a gauge field that you integrate over a curve. That's your knot. Mm. And then you couple the Wilson loop to in the most simple case, you just couple the loop to a one scalar field. So you have the holonomy of the gauge, the integral of the holonomy, you integrate the connection over the knot. But then you add one scalar field, phi. And then you say that that phi essentially picks out a point on S2. So
I don't need any scalar fields. I don't know
what gauge theory is. So this is not here. I'm just giving you the gauge theory interpretation of this.
Okay.
I think there's this thing going on, right? So the S2 parameterizes the scalar fields. Like he's somehow relating that to the direction of the knot by some kind of twist. I suspect there's some twisting procedure.
Yes, that's what that.
But like the flavor symmetry and the rotations and space time are linked.
I mean, yeah. It seems clear from the physics point of view that you're studying supersymmetric surfaces, and those are usually associated to some coupling of the gauge field and the scalars in some symmetric way that you preserve some supersymmetry. But the statement I'm making more generically is that maybe for this ADS 4 times S2 story, it's like that, but the generically supersymmetry, which is kind of the analog of J holomorphic curves, do not imply any solution of supersymmetry does not imply a solution to the equations of motion. That's all I'm saying. I.e. minimal surfaces. That's a generic thing in supersymmetry. Supersymmetry does not imply a solution of the equations of motion.
Okay.
But in this particular example, you seem to say that. By the way, exactly this case has been studied in the physics literature.
Mm-hmm.
And there actually the same statement was made, but I don't know if there were some assumptions that any solution of the J holomorphic curves corresponding to a minimal surface, to a solution of. To a solution of the equations of motion. But I think generically, if you study, for example, ADS 5 times S5, that's not true. Like hyperbolic, five-dimensional hyperbolic space times a phi sphere.
Absolutely. This is a four-dimensional statement.
Yeah.
I mean, it's studied in the physics literature, but this exact statement, I think, goes back to like 1980 in the maths literature.
Well, could be, yeah. The version of this statement where you replace Z by ADS 5 times S, okay, a hyperbolic 5 times S5, and you replace the boundary with, minimal surfaces but that's the thing, okay. I'm still confused by some basic statement.
There's another example in which this is completely, I mean, this is due to Weierstrass. If you look at minimal surfaces in R3, their Gauss map lands in R3 cross S2.
Yeah.
You see? So if I have a minimal surface inside R3, I can talk about its Gauss map going to S2, and it's holomorphic. And that's how you can construct minimal, I mean, classically, that's how people construct minimal surfaces in R3. So geomorphic maps from a Riemann, from a surface to CP1, you can integrate them up to get minimal surfaces in R3.
I guess the question I'm asking is, shouldn't there be some kind of statement relating minimal surface on H4 times S2 to supersymmetric surfaces on ADS4, on H4 times S2? That's more akin of the statement that we would find in the physics literature.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't think I can answer your question. But this modulo, the caveat about the vertical curves is...
I mean, mathematically, it's well defined to say what are the minimal surfaces in H4 times S2 with suitable boundary conditions, right?
I'm only looking at the minimal surfaces in H4.
Yeah, I understand. But so you don't know the analog of that statement if you study minimal surface on H4 times H2.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So here's a rough sketch of the contents of the talk. So I was going to start with a brief and very incomplete history of the mathematical approach to counting minimal surfaces, which people have been doing for over 100 years. Then I was going to give you a clean statement of the main theorem. Then I was going to explain how geomorphic curves come along. And then I was going to explain some of the ideas involved in the compactness parts of the proofs. And then at that point, we'll almost certainly have run out of time. Okay, but if we had more time, that's what I would talk about. So what would it mean to try and write down a skein relation for these invariants? That's how you might move towards showing that you recover Homfly PT or something like that. How might you try and categorify this invariant? So there's an approach to that involving G2 geometry of Z cross R. And how might you count minimal surfaces in other Riemannian four manifolds besides H4? And how might you count produce knot invariants by counting geomorphic curves in other six symplectic six manifolds whose boundaries look like Y, a three manifold cross S2? So there should be a class of symplectic manifolds who have a singularity at their boundary, six manifolds, who have a certain type of singularity on their boundary that looks like this, and that when you count the right geomorphic curves, you should get knot invariants of knots in Y. Okay, let's go back a long, long way to counting minimal surfaces in R3, and I live in Belgium, so I'm contractually obliged to talk about the Plateau problem because Plateau was a Belgian scientist. So I have to remind you all of how Belgian he was. And the Plateau problem was, given a closed curve in R3, when does it bound a minimal surface? So this is a very classical problem. And in the 1930s, Douglas and Rado showed it always bounds a minimal disk. The disk could be horrible and singular and immersed and all sorts of things, but the loop will bound for you a minimal disk. And for a long time, people looked for conditions that would ensure that the disk was embedded. And that was eventually solved by Burma, Tommy, and Tromba, who proved a more general result than this, but let me just explain this result. So if your loop lies entirely inside the two-sphere in R3, then there is indeed a minimal disk that fills it, that's embedded. And they proved this using degree theory. So let me just sketch the idea, because it's exactly the same as the idea that I'm going to use to count minimal surfaces. So you look at Curly C, that's the space of all the embedded circles in S2. Just as each point of C corresponds to a circle inside S2. And then we look at the embedded minimal disks with boundary inside S2, that's Curly M. And obviously there's a map from Curly M to Curly C, which just remembers the boundary of a disk. Okay. And the point is that these are both infinite dimensional manifolds. B is Fredholm, index 0. So the pre-image of a point here is going to be a zero-dimensional manifold here, and moreover, this B is proper, so I can count the number of points in the pre-image. See? And I think when Tommy and Tromba did their work, they didn't count with signs, they just counted modulo 2. So there's this, anyone who's done Gromov-Witten theory knows you have to include the signs. If you don't, you just get an invariant mod 2. But that's all they needed for their theorem. And then you can explicitly compute the number of minimal disks, embedded minimal disks that fill the equator in S2. So it's the same picture that I drew before. There's just one. So we know that the degree is equal to one because we found a fiber for which we can compute it. But if this map has degree one, then it must be surjective, you see? Because if it missed a point, I could use the point that's not in the image to compute the degree and I'd have got zero. And that's a contradiction. Okay, so once you have a well-defined degree that's non-zero, the map is surjective, and that proves their theorem. Okay, so now let's look at counting minimal surfaces in H3. And this one we want to do the asymptotic plateau problem. So let me just start in n dimensions. So I look at the n-dimensional sphere, which is the boundary of n plus one-dimensional hyperbolic space, and I take a k-dimensional submanifold inside Sn, and I ask, is there a k plus one-dimensional minimal submanifold that has that as its boundary. And in the 1980s, Mike Anderson proved that you could always find your minimal submanifold, provided you were prepared to be sufficiently relaxed about what you meant by submanifold. So you need to use integral currents and geometric measure theory and things like that, but the M exists. And this is a fantastic result because it tells you the existence, but it's also awkward because it doesn't tell you anything about the topology of M. You just know there exists some integral current that fills your N. So then in 2010, Alex Sakis and Matt Seo tried to run the same program that Tommy and Tromba had done for minimal embedded minimal surfaces, counting embedded minimal surfaces in H3. So they looked at the following space. So you look at the properly embedded minimal surfaces in H3. G is the genus and K is the number of boundary components. See? And they're properly embedded, so they run out to infinity and they meet the two sphere at infinity in K different circles. So let's look at the space of all the embedded copies of K circles in the sphere. And then the theorem that they proved was that this boundary map is again Fredholm, index zero and proper, so it has this well-defined degree. So I've been a bit naughty here. The degree, I've written it as if it depends only on the genus and K. But if you think carefully, this space is not connected. When K is at least 3, you can find configurations of circles that are disjoint that can't be taken one into the other. You can have this situation or this situation. See, they're different, even in the two sphere. But it turns out the degree does only depend upon G and K. In fact, it turns out to be quite easy to compute in a lot of cases. So what is this degree? So when you're counting disks that fill a circle, the answer's 1. Just again, you've got the equator and the single disk that fills it. And because there are no higher genus surfaces that fill the equator, the degree when G is bigger than 0 and the number of circles is 1 is 0. And now there's a really important example which explains how to compute another degree. So this is due to Mori, but not Mori of Bend and Break, a different Japanese mathematician called Mori. You're supposed to think of this picture rotated around the z-axis, okay? So the green circle becomes the two sphere. And what we're going to do is we're going to try and count minimal annuli that fill circles of latitude. So I look at this circle of latitude here and this circle of latitude here, and I want to look at a minimal filling of those two circles, okay? And because I've imposed this symmetry, it's not hard to check all the solutions are also symmetric. And so it comes down to an ODE for these profile curves. So if you rotate this particular curve all the way around, you'll get a minimal surface that fills those two circles of latitude. And what Mori was able to show is that when the circles are quite close to the equator, there are two solutions. One runs a long way in and one stays near infinity. And as you push the circles further out, these two solutions move together. And then there's a critical value at which they coalesce. And then beyond that value, they disappear. So the degree is 0. And what's happening is here, they ought to be counted with opposite signs. See? So I'm going to come back to this example because I thought I'd understood everything I could from it, but it turned out that the bug in my proof is already contained in this example. So I'll explain that in a bit. Okay, so then Teen was able to compute all the degrees for different genus and number of components. And what he did was he proved all these degrees are 0, except for the one that we've seen that's not 0. So the idea is, just like we have for Mori's picture, when the circles are a long way apart, the surface that runs between them becomes too thin in the middle and it disappears. So Teen proved if you took some of your circles up here and one circle down here, very small, then there was no way to find a minimal surface that filled them because it would have to be too thin in the middle. It would contradict monotonicity. Okay, so there's one other thing that I want to talk about in this brief potted history of counting things. So there are lots of different ways to define knot invariance via geomorphic curves. And I'm only going to mention one of them, and that's because this is the one that looks most similar to what I've been doing. So you can take take the total space of this vector bundle over CP1, O of minus 1 plus O of minus 1. And that's like a local Calabi-Yau. So it's a Calabi-Yau threefold. And if I give you, it's the resolution of the conifold, you see? And if I give you a link or a knot inside S3, there's a way to produce from this guy a Lagrangian inside the resolved conifold, okay? As a procedure for doing it, you use the fact that the conifold is related to T star of S3. So the link, the co-normal of the link is a Lagrangian in here, and then you do a conifold transition on your Lagrangian, and it becomes a Lagrangian in the resolution, okay? If those words mean something to you, that's great. If they don't, it doesn't matter. And so you can count Gromov-Witten invariants, open Gromov-Witten invariants with boundary on this Lagrangian. And if you do that in the right way, you discover the Homfly-PT polynomial of K. So this was conjectured by Aguri and Vaffa using ideas from physics. And then it was proven much more recently by Tobias Ekholm and Vivek Schender. So they managed to define this open Gromov-Witten invariant rigorously, and then prove that it was equal to the Homfly-PT polynomial of the knot. Now, what's this got to do with what we're doing? So this X topologically is just R4 cross S2. And the miracle is that actually it's the same thing as this twister space that I've been talking about. Moreover, you can write down this identification in such a way that the symplectic form on X, the Kähler form on X, from its Calabi-Yau structure, is compatible with this magical Z that sees minimal surfaces. You see? So if you were to do Ekholm-Schender's count with this Z, you'd expect to get the Homfly-PT polynomial. Only this Z's not generic, so probably you shouldn't use it to do their count. The other thing that's very different is they're talking about Lagrangian boundary conditions that are determined in this slightly mysterious way by the knot. Whereas I'm not talking about Lagrangian boundary conditions at all. The boundary conditions are completely nailed down by the knot. Okay, so since this is a talk about mathematics, I ought to give you a complete, clean statement of the main theorem. So unfortunately, this is just a little bit long. So let's talk about the genus G case filling links, because at least some of the theorem is still true. My notation is sigma is a Riemann surface with boundary. Sigma bar is the compact Riemann surface with boundary. And when I remove the bar, that's the interior of the Riemann surface. Okay, I know that's confusing if you're used to thinking of Riemann surfaces with a complex conjugate structure, but we just have to live with the notation. This is the notation that analysts use for analysis on manifolds with boundary. So I'm stuck with it, I'm afraid. So it's a compact surface, genus G, K boundary components. And then B bar is the closed unit ball in R4. And then my moduli space is this guy. It's pairs. F is a map from sigma bar into B bar. J is a Riemann surface structure on sigma bar, conformal class. And I want my map to be C2 alpha. So normally when you do geometric analysis, it doesn't really matter what K and alpha you put here. But it turns out in this story, you want 2 alpha there. You really do. And I'll explain why in a bit. The next thing I want is that this Riemann surface meets the boundary of the ball in the boundary of the Riemann surface, and it meets it transversely. So this surface is being mapped into B bar, and near the boundary, it's a smooth embedding that meets the boundary of the ball transversely. This J is a conformal structure on sigma bar, or turn sigma bar into a Riemann surface, and I want this map F to be conformal with respect to the Euclidean structure on the ball. And then the final thing I want is that on the interior, I want F to be harmonic. I want it to be a harmonic map with respect to the hyperbolic metric on the interior of the ball. So this is an equation that holds all the way up to the boundary, but not on the boundary, because the metric doesn't make sense on the boundary. So this harmonic condition only makes sense on the interior of sigma. And you might ask, so this equivalence relation, if I have a diffeomorphism of sigma bar, I can use it to pull back the J and I can use it to pull back the F, and the two things are equivalent if they differ by a diffeomorphism. Okay. So that's this moduli space, and you should think of this as the moduli space of minimal surfaces. For what reason? The reason is that if you have a conformal harmonic map, which is an embedding or an immersion, its images are minimal. Okay, that's a theorem from harmonic map theory. So it really is, this moduli space really is a moduli space of minimal surfaces. And compared with what I was talking about before, so this work of Alexakis and Matseo looking at minimal surfaces in H3, or Tommy and Tromba looking at minimal surfaces inside R3, they were interested in embedded surfaces. Whereas here, I've parameterized my surfaces by conformal harmonic maps. So why has that happened? It's because minimal surfaces, when they have codimension 1, they don't pick up branch points when you move them. They can't immerse. You have a minimal surface, it can't touch itself by the maximum principle, you see? So you don't, if you start with something that's embedded and you move it, it will never touch itself. It will never become immersed. And equally, it will never pick up a branch point, because a branch point is a kind of infinitesimal immersion, immersed point, you see? However, we definitely know of examples of minimal surfaces in 4 dimensions where this happens. You just look at holomorphic curves in C2. Or CP2, if you want a compact example. You can take a smooth holomorphic curve and move it, and it becomes, it self-intersects, or it snaps, or, you know, it becomes immersed, it picks up branch points. It can become, you know, look at the space of cubics in CP2. Lots of them have branch points or singularities. So we can't avoid them. So we should just accept them. And that means we can't talk about submanifolds. We have to talk about the parameterizing maps, because the images of these guys aren't going to be submanifolds. They're not even going to locally be graphs in some situations. Okay, the next part of the notation I need is the analog of the space of the boundary components. So CK for me is just K disjoint circles embedded in S3, and I want the embedding to be C2 alpha. So the connected components of this space CK are just the space of links, see? Okay, links with K components. So in K equals 1, this is an infinite dimensional manifold. Each component corresponds to a type of a knot. And here's the main theorem. So the first thing is that this space of minimal surfaces is actually an infinite dimensional Banach manifold. It's smooth. The minimal surfaces are unobstructed. You can't find one. Anytime you find one, all of the infinitesimal deformations that look like it should keep it minimal, they integrate up to genuine minimal surfaces. So I can use the theory of Banach manifolds to discuss these guys. The boundary map, if I have a minimal surface, then I can just look at the boundary. The boundary is one of these links, C2 alpha link with K components. And this map is Fredholm of index 0. Okay. So we should hope to be able to count minimal surfaces with fixed boundary, fixed ideal boundary. And when the genus is 0 and the number of components is 1, when we're looking at minimal disks filling knots, this map is actually proper. Okay, so what I haven't explained here is the orientations, but the orientations work in exactly the same way as they always do with geomorphic curves. So let me completely elide that point. So you can count the number of minimal disks that fill a given knot with the appropriate signs, and you get an integer. So provided you choose a generic knot, you see, it'll be a regular value of B. The pre-image will be a finite set of points. They all come with signs. I count them with signs. I get a number, and that number won't change under isotopies of K, because it's the degree of a map. And that's the invariant. So the conjecture that I thought I'd proved is the following. So in other cases, this map is not going to be proper. Something can go wrong. But it turns out that the space of links inside here, where the bad things happen, ought to be codimension 2. So if you believe that there's a codimension 2 space of these bad links where properness fails, you can still run this program. You take a link that's not bad and that's a regular value of the map. You count the number of points in the pre-image. If you take any two such links, because the bad links are codimension 2, you can walk around the bad set. You see, you can go from one link to another link or not, avoiding the bad set because it's codimension 2. You see? So you'd still get a well-defined invariant. Even though B is not proper, you restrict it to this space where it is. And that would mean that you'd have this well-defined invariant of links. So I'll explain more about this in a second. Okay, but even the amount of the theorem that's proved, there's this corollary that I mentioned. So any unknotted circle in S3 bounds a minimal disk because we can compute the invariant for the unknot and it's one. The minimal number of minimal disks that fill the unknot is equal to one for a specific instance of the unknot. So now if I take any unknot, no matter how wiggly in the boundary of hyperbolic space, as long as it's C2 alpha for some alpha, then it'll be filled by a minimal disk somewhere inside. Okay, so now let me give you an example of a bad link. Okay, so this example was due to Teen, my PhD student, and I found it extremely illuminating. So let's take the completely standard Hopf link. So what do I mean by that? I mean, I think of my three sphere as living inside C2, and I just take the intersection of the three sphere with the two coordinate lines. Okay. So that gives me a pair of circles inside the three sphere that are linked. It's the Hopf link. And what Teen was able to prove is that the only way to fill this with a minimal surface is to take the obvious geodesic disks that fill it. So the intersection of these coordinate lines with the ball is two copies of H2 inside H4 that fill the Hopf link. And that's the only minimal surface that fills this guy. Okay. However, there is a family of Hopf links, deformations of this H0 parameterized by T in R2. And each of these guys is filled by a minimal annulus. And what's happening is that as T tends to zero, this minimal annulus that fills one of the Hopf links is pinching. Its waist is becoming thinner and thinner. And in the limit, you get this pair of disks that I can't draw as a transverse intersection because I'm restricted to three dimensions. Okay. So if you wanted to count minimal annuli, you'd expect these Hopf links to be filled by one minimal annulus, the one that Teen's found. So what's happened to it when we run to H0? That's a problem, isn't it? It's degenerated into a pair of disks. So if we insist on counting these smooth minimal, not smooth, these minimal surfaces, which are the image of smooth Riemann surfaces, then we need to avoid bad links like this H0. And Teen's family really has two parameters in it, which is suggesting to us that these bad links that we're avoiding are dimension two, codimension two. And I'll explain more about why they're codimension two in a minute when I've described twister space. So I'm going to rapidly tell you what the twister space is. Hopefully this can be followed by people who haven't seen twister space before. So pick H4, choose an orientation and pick a point P in H4. And I'm going to tell you what the fiber of twister space is over that point. So I look at all the different ways of writing down a complex structure on the tangent space at that point, which are compatible with the metric. So these J's need to be orthogonal. And they also need to agree with the orientation that I've chosen. And if you do that, and you can see there's a two sphere worth of choices. And all of these two spheres fit together to give you this bundle over H4, this two sphere bundle, which is the twister space. You can do this with any oriented Riemannian four manifold. I've just chosen to write it out for H4. And this Z has tautological almost complex structures. So if you look at the tangent space to Z, there's a piece that's vertical, that's tangent to the fibers of this map. And then there's a horizontal complement, which comes from the Levi-Civita connection. So now I want to write down my J on this tangent space. I know what to do on V, because V is just the tangent space to the two sphere. And the two sphere has a complex structure. So I know what to do there. I just take the obvious guy. What do I do on H? So what I do on H will depend on where I am in the twister space. So at some point on the twister space, this horizontal space just looks like the tangent space downstairs. And the point in the twister space is a J on this space. You see? That's the whole point of the twister space. It parameterizes the complex structures downstairs. So there's a kind of tautological J on this H. So now I can just take the sum of the J on V and the J on H. But there was a choice in this game. I could have taken minus the J on the H, and that's what I'm going to do. Okay, so this, if I took the plus, that gives you something that Penrose introduced and then was studied in this Riemannian setting by Atiyah, Hitchin and Singer. It gives you an almost complex structure on your twister space that has a chance to be integrable. So this is where twister theory normally goes. But I don't want to do that. I want to do this J minus that was introduced by Eales and Salomon. And it's an almost complex structure that's never integrable. And why do I want to do that? Because of this correspondence that I was talking about. So suppose I have a J allomorphic curve into this twister space with J minus. Then the projection downstairs is a conformal harmonic map. Conversely, I can lift a conformal harmonic map into H4 up into the twister space. So let me just explain how to do that. So let me just pretend that this map is an immersion. It'll be an if it's conformal and harmonic, it'll be an immersion away from a finite set anyway. So let's just look at points where it's an immersion. How do I lift the point? I look at the tangent space to my image. That's a two-dimensional space inside a four-dimensional space. And it turns out there's a unique point in the twister space that gives me a J that makes that a complex line. So it's a bit like the Gauss map, you see? So that lifts my Riemann surface back into the twister space. And this lift is J allomorphic if I started with something that was conformal harmonic. So that's this correspondence that I was talking about earlier that led to this conversation about boundary conditions. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the non-vertical holomorphic curves in Z and the conformal harmonic maps to H4. Okay, and again, this works for any oriented Riemannian four manifold, not just H4. I've just chosen to write it for H4. Okay, so there I'm reinforcing the difference with the standard situation. You can't just look at a book on Gromov-Witten theory and then read off the answer, because this J is singular as you run to the boundary. And what that means is that when you look at the J allomorphic curve equation on sigma, it becomes degenerate on the boundary of sigma in the directions normal to the curve. So you can't even read off standard elliptic results about this PDE. You need to do some genuine analysis, and you need to use a machinery called the zero calculus introduced by Matseo and Melrose. But I appreciate this isn't an audience of geometric analysts, so I won't say any more about that. But the end result is you can use all of that technology. That's how you prove that this space of minimal surfaces is smooth. The space of J allomorphic curves is smooth. Infinite dimensional Banach manifold. And this boundary map is Fredholm. So now let me talk about this bad set. So what can go wrong? As you move this minimal surface, one of the things that can happen as you move the boundary knot and try and follow it with a J allomorphic curve, the conformal structure of the Riemann surface can degenerate. That's what we saw in these minimal annuli filling hot flinks. You see, the conformal structure degenerated and the waist pinched. And here's a picture of that happening. So there's a minimal surface. Let's pretend I was trying to count genus one minimal surfaces filling a knot. I thought I'd done it. I moved the knot and lo and behold, the minimal surface pinched. You see? But if I think of this as a J allomorphic curve in twister space, what I actually have is a curve that touches itself in one place. But if you take curves, complex curves in an almost surfaces inside a six manifold, two surfaces or the same surface self-intersecting, a dimension 2 + 2 = 4, and the ambient space is dimension 6. So it's a codimension 2 phenomenon. So if you start looking at the J allomorphic curves, you're led to believe that this ought to be codimension 2 in the space of knots. Okay, and I thought that's what I proved. So the limit is some J allomorphic curve that meets itself. So this is just me writing down everything I just said. Maybe I can just whiz that past your eyes. However, something might go wrong. And what might go wrong that I had an argument to eliminate this, but it doesn't work. So in H4, When the node forms, you see this pair of minimal surfaces. You see? If when you lift to twister space, you just see the same sort of picture, then that's all okay. That's a codimension 2 phenomenon. But what might happen that I can't yet control is that at the same time the node develops, a bubble develops in the geolomorphic curve. That bubble has to be a vertical twister line, because there can't be any bubbles that aren't vertical, because if they're not vertical, they project down to a minimal sphere in H4, and there are no minimal spheres in H4. There are no compact minimal surfaces at all in H4. So the horrible thing that could happen is this bubble appears at the same time as the node. We're awfully unlucky. You see? And then in twister space, we have this picture, where the two minimal surfaces that are going to intersect here, their twister lifts are separated by this twister line. Okay? Now, this, if J were generic, this wouldn't be a problem at all. If J were generic, these twister lines would be isolated. You see? So again, we'd be in the situation where we had three curves that met in these points, and it would be, you know, this curve meeting one of the holomorphic twister lines would be codimension 2 already. So this would be codimension 4. And we'd be away. But the problem is J is not generic. These CP1s, they ought to be isolated. They ought to be a moduli space of dimension 0. But they're not. They're a moduli space of dimension 4, because there's one for every point in H4. So the fact that they're not generic means that you can't rule them out just by staring at dimensions. But also the fact that they're non-generic means that you probably shouldn't be able to smooth this picture. It shouldn't arise except in codimension 4 as the limit of Riemann surfaces in twister space. See? So morally, this phenomenon ought to occur even less than this. This still ought to happen in codimension 4. So I'm hopeful that with a little bit more effort, I can prove this happens. This happens in at least codimension 2. Anyway, that's where I am. So the reason that everything still works for the disks is because, of course, the moduli of the disk never changes. So there's no node happening at the same time as the bubble. And in fact, this bubble appearing at the same time as a node, we've already seen an explicit example. Much to my chagrin, my PhD student had explained this example to me by showing me Mori's paper about 2 years ago, and I failed to notice the full significance. If you look at the Gauss map of this curve here, you can see as I run round here, the normal is filling out the whole sphere as I rotate. You see? This is a three-dimensional example, but the idea still applies. So as these two circles are coming together, the limit from the point of view of H3 looks like a pair of disks. See? But the Gauss map blows up in the twister space and you get a whole CP1 bubble vertically. We don't quite have this picture. Oops, I hate it when people move the slides when I'm trying to look at them. We don't quite have this picture because the two disks come in at the same point on the twister line. See, because they're tangent. But still, nonetheless, it shows that a bubble can form at the same time as a node. So it's not a feature that we could just eliminate completely. It's something that will happen. But I believe it happens in codimension 4. Okay, there's only 5 minutes left, so I don't know to what extent it's worth me sketching out ideas in the proof of properness or anything like this. But there's maybe one thing that's worth saying, which is, why did I only care about bubbles forming when a node happened? And the reason is that you can't have bubbles anywhere else. And the reason is a Bochner formula for the energy density. So if you look at your Riemann surface, it has a complete hyperbolic metric. You see, so on the, which makes the boundary go off to infinity. And I want to use that hyperbolic metric. That's the right one to use. If you think about the minimal disk that's just totally geodesic, its inherited metric is the metric on H2. It's this hyperbolic guy. I use that metric to compute the energy density of my conformal maps. You can prove that the energy density tends to 1 at infinity. As you run towards infinity, these minimal surfaces look more and more like totally geodesic guys. And then you can use Bochner's formula to prove, and a maximum principle, to prove that the energy density is actually less than 1 everywhere, less than or equal to 1. And that's crucially uses the fact that H4's got negative curvature. The end result is that bubbles never appear as long as you've got control of the metrics. See, so if I take a sequence of minimal surfaces whose conformal structures don't degenerate, then I'll have complete control over all of the energies. So no bubbles can form at all. The problem can only happen, the bubbles can only appear where the node is, where the node is forming. Where the node forms, I lose control over the metrics because they're becoming singular. See? Okay, that's probably all I should try and say in 1 hour. Anything beyond this point takes would take at least 5 or 10 minutes to explain. So why don't I stop here, and then you can have a little bit of time to ask any questions if you want to. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. So, questions?
I'd also be happy to hear more comments about this this scalar field business.
That's true. Do people have questions for Jean-Marc?
I'm happy to listen to the answers. I mean, I'm completely ignorant of all of the physics. That's one of the reasons I think why Kevin asked me to give the talk, because he thought people here might be able to help me. So I'm all ears.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to discuss it. Maybe it would be more useful, maybe if we do it privately, but if you want, I can say some basic things of what's the kind of question that kind of, see, this is similar to what you do. So I mean, the first thing that's not quite the same is that you look at surfaces in hyperbolic space P times a sphere Q, okay? And P and Q depends on what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. The kind of problem that, there are two separate questions that you can ask. One is, and the hyperbolic space can either be, oh, those are details. I mean, you like to be the one could take the, like the, such that the conformal boundary is the plane as opposed to the sphere. But
okay, sure.
These are details. So the kind of problem that there's been a lot of work on is to try to find surfaces that with fixed boundary conditions at the boundary of the hyperbolic space and with some kind of Dirichlet boundary condition on the sphere.
Okay, yeah.
And those guys compute is in the semi-classical approach, in some regime, they compute the expectation value of a Wilson loop in the gate theory that lives at the boundary of the hyperbolic space. Okay. And but this I mean, you didn't write down explicitly what this J holomorphic equation is, but from what I gather, I mean, from what I know, is that these are more closely related to another notion. So usually we study string theory in backgrounds that have some killing spinners. So they're invariant of some supersymmetries. Mm-hmm. And then you can ask a different question, not to look for the minimal surface, but to look at surfaces that preserve a certain amount of supersymmetry that's compatible with the choice of boundary conditions. And somehow this latter problem has been studied much less. I think, and studying that other problem is more complicated. I mean, so I think studying the minimal surface problem seems a bit simpler, but.
So this yeah. Supersymmetry is what enables you to write down the J holomorphic curve equation, am I right?
So, okay, so that's what I was discussing with, I don't know if he's here, with Lucas. So I think the J holomorphic equations can be obtained by choosing, so a particular supersymmetry as a spinner associated to a pure spinner. So you take your supersymmetric equations, you pick that you want an unbroken supersymmetry to be a pure spinner. That from that you can construct what I call a J holomorphic equation. So you didn't write it down, but I think we're talking about the same object. So supersymmetry implies a J holomorphic equation, but the supersymmetry equations are more general.
I see.
And it better be the case because, I mean, I think in general we expect, and in complete examples, we know that the supersymmetric equations do not necessarily solve the equations of motion, but are not minimal area.
So the equation, so these, we're still looking at surfaces inside the product of hyperbolic space and a sphere.
Yeah.
And are the supersymmetric equations second order And the geolomorphic curve equation is first order.
Yeah, that's first order. No, so that's specific equation of first order.
The supersymmetric equations are also first order.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I call, they're like analogs of J holomorphic equations. Yeah.
Okay.
And that, and more concretely, given a choice of a pure spinner, you can construct a J holomorphic equation.
Okay.
But that's not the most general supersymmetric surface. The J holomorphic surface is not the most general. Is not the most general supersymmetric surface.
Okay, I think I'm beginning. I think I'm beginning to at least understand schematically what you're saying. I see. So I suspect my geolomorphic curve equation is just that the derivative of my map is complex linear, where I use the Riemann surface structure on the Riemann surface, yeah, and the J and Z, yeah. And this twister space, it's a in a very natural way, it's an almost Calabi-Yau manifold. So it has a symplectic form, it has this J,
yeah,
and it has a unit length complex volume form. And the only thing that's stopping it being a genuine Calabi-Yau is that the imaginary part of this complex volume form isn't closed, but the real part's closed.
Mm-hmm.
So probably you could, from there, produce your pure spinner whose corresponding geolomorphic curve equation is the one I'm studying. You see? Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying that given a pure spinner, there is a given a pure spinner and its conjugate, you can construct canonically an almost complex structure that's not integrable in general.
Right, and that's exactly what you'll get from this complex three form, complex valued unit length three form. It's got the right type. I guess this is equivalent to it being pure spinner formalism. It has the right type to be. There's this paper by Hitchin on three forms, stable three forms.
Yeah.
It produces for you, it recovers for you the J. You don't need the J, you only need the three form. That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think I am, my geolomorphic curves are the same as what yours are. What's curious is that I don't need any extra boundary conditions. They're kind of hardwired in. What happens on the two sphere is determined by what happens in R3.
No, but that's because in some sense you've chosen a very... I mean, in my language, you've probably chosen a very specific.
But there are no other solutions that are geolomorphic curves in my sense with a different choice of boundary condition on the S2.
No, once you've chosen the boundary condition, you're already committed. You're already committed to.
No. What I mean is, if you look at geolomorphic curves,
mm-hmm,
that run out to the boundary, that do something on the S2 and project to a knot in R3. The geolomorphic curve equation itself forces the S2 component to just be the tangential lift of the knot. So there's no other choice.
Yeah. I what I'm saying is that there are much more. I think one way of saying it is that you've studied a very specific class of Wilson loops in my language, in which what's happened on the sphere and what happens on ADS are kind of tied by the hip. But that's not the most general thing you could do.
Sure. You could look for other boundary conditions. I agree, but yeah, then there would be no geolomorphic curves with those boundary conditions.
But I would say that no. I mean, there are. I think there are some J holomorphic equations that you can write down.
They're not my geolomorphic. They're not the same as mine.
No. For example, the most general one. I mean, the most interesting case is the case of ADS5 and S5. So we're not even talking about the same space. But
sure,
you can write down kind of a J holomorphic equation on ADS5 and S5.
I think there's a big difference between S2 and S5, right? I mean, this is what your sentiment is only true for S2, right?
Oh, absolutely. My statement is true for geolomorphic curves in twister spaces of Riemannian four manifolds,
yeah,
which are asymptotically hyperbolic. Then what I'm saying is true. If you do the same thing for higher dimensional manifolds, then there's freedom in how you lift the knot in the boundary of the manifold up into the twister space. There's a choice, and you definitely see a field. Yeah,
I think there's yeah.
But I wouldn't be looking at spheres then. I would be looking at, I mean, the fibers of higher dimensional twister spaces. So if you go up to six dimensions, I guess the fibers are copies of CP3 rather than S2.
For us, we don't insist on you. Twister space is was an accident. From this point of view, two spaces is an accident. We don't.
Okay, yeah, that's very interesting. That means that there's even more spaces to consider.
Yeah, I mean, there are all the examples of ADS-CFT. You can study. I mean, a basic observable is to study the minimal surface with fixed boundary conditions at the boundary of ADS with the sphere. I mean, you have to impose some kind of Dirichlet problem there.
Okay, I'm beginning to understand. I see now why you were mystified, because from your perspective, what I presented, there was a missing ingredient.
And actually, we expect in general that for example, you said like that for the unknown, you have like the minimal surface, which is an ADS2 surface.
Yes.
And that's the minimal, that's the minimal surface in ADS. But what I'm saying is that for more generic boundary conditions, actually, we expect a continuous family of supersymmetric solutions that are not minimal surfaces.
I see. Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you say minimal surface, you compute the area from the
induced. Yeah, the mean curvature vector vanishes. So it's critical for area under compact perturbations. That's right.
Yeah.
But okay. My surfaces again, they're in H4. They're not in H4 cross S2. The minimal surface.
Yeah, but essentially, for the unknot, you get like an ADS2 essentially.
That's right. Yeah.
Which, by the way, I mean, you know, the area of ADS2 is minus 2 pi. You know this.
Yes, the renormalized area is minus 2 pi, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the point is that in the more general setup, one specs surfaces that end on the boundary on the unknown, but as they spread into ADS times the sphere, mm-hmm. they have the area increases. Sorry, the area. Yeah, well, the area, the action increases from minus 2 pi to some other bigger value.
Ah, okay, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. Okay. Because, so another thing one of my PhD student team proved is that if you take any minimal surface inside just H4 mm-hmm. and you look at its renormalized area, the largest it can be is minus 2 pi. It can't be any bigger.
Largest, you mean smaller? No,
it's either, it could be more negative than minus 2 pi. I think that's right. If it's minimal,
why is it the minimum? So why is ADS2 the minimal surface with a fixed boundary?
Well, it's totally geodesic. So,
I mean, I don't know what this word means. I thought to me, okay. I mean, to me, a minimal surface is something that kind of how do I say it in a more mathy way? Well, you have a. I mean, you look at the induced metric, and you just look at the equations that determine. How do I say it? I'm worried that I was hitting words that you will not know. You can start with an action functional, which is the determinant of the induced metric on the surface. Okay, mm-hmm. And now you look at the saddle points of this.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, the solutions of those are what I call extremal surfaces, right?
We call them minimal in mathematics.
Minimal, okay.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate use of terminology. They don't minimize, they are critical points of the area functional. Yeah.
But I thought in the case of when the boundary is a circle, that ADS2 is the minimal action or minimal area object, but you're saying no.
But the problem is that you've renormalized the area, so.
Yeah, I remove an infinity, so the finite part is minus 2 pi.
That's right. And what I'm saying is if you found another minimal surface, its renormalized area, I think, would be less than or equal to minus 2 pi.
This seems to be inconsistent with what we expect physically, because we're saying that by definition, minimal surface.
Let me check that I've got the sign right there. Hang on a second.
I think you have the sign. I mean, I would say that the sign is the other way, but.
I'm just checking.
I think we're probably torturing all kinds of people here if they want to leave. I think Kevin ran out, which is probably wise.
Usually people aren't shy about just bouncing during the question period, so I wouldn't worry too much.
Okay.
In fact, I might have to go.
No, the renormalized area is at most minus 2 pi for any minimal surface in hyperbolic space.
So, okay, so let me ask. So imagine I'm in a hyperbolic space. Mm-hmm. Does this matter the dimension of the hyperbolic space or not?
No.
So do you know which surface would have area which is smaller than minus 2 pi? More negative than minus 2 pi?
Yes, I guess if you take one of these annuli that fill a Hopflink, it will have renormalized area smaller than minus 2 pi.
I'm telling you, fix the boundary to be a circle.
No, there's only one minimal surface that fills that. That's the point.
No, that's what I'm saying. Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
And it's got minimal air. It's got air, but I'm talking about...
You're asking you're giving an answer to a different question. I'm saying I fix the boundary to be the unknown.
Okay. There's only one minimal surface that fills the round unknown.
Okay, that's exactly, yeah. I thought you were saying that there were other surfaces that had a smaller area.
No. There are no other minimal surfaces. Yeah.
Okay. Then we're in the chat. So what I'm saying in this particular example is that there are other surfaces that are not minimal or extreme or whatever word you want to use, and that have bigger action, a bigger area.
Sorry, say that again. I'm not sure I quite...
That there are surfaces that are supersymmetric, that end on the circle at the boundary, and that have area bigger than mine.
Okay, I see. They can't correspond to just minimal surfaces in hyperbolic.
Exactly. That's the point I was making. That.
Yeah.
Something can be supersymmetric and not minimal.
Okay. Okay, that's very interesting. Thank you. Yeah.
Somehow the supersymmetric it's a bit surprising that the supersymmetric equations have not been studied mathematically somehow. Supersymmetric embedding equations have not been studied mathematically, as far as I can tell.
I'd be very interested to see how different they are from just the geomorphic curve equations that I've been looking at. If you could send me some references, that would be very useful.
Yeah. Maybe I can send you some notes. I mean, So typically, the supersymmetric equation, it's a lot of details I would tell you, but essentially, a subset of the equations do look like the J holomorphic equations with some choice of. So the other thing that's important in this business is that you may have to complexify things a little bit. So you may have to complexify hyperbolic space or the sphere, and then choose some contour, some reality property for your fields.
Okay, that's fine. That sort of thing happens in twister theory.
Yeah, and also when you do localization in quantum field theory or maybe even in mathematics, sometimes you have to choose an unusual contour that finds a real structure on the space of fields. That is very important in this business. So maybe the mismatch partially is that we are discussing different choices of contour.
Mm-hmm. In the space I see. I see. Well, if you could send me
a
reference or something like that so that I could look at these equations, and then I can see in the situations that I understand if there's something more there than the J holomorphic curve equations that I've been studying. I mean, from what you're saying, there definitely is in all the interesting examples for you, but I wonder if it's also true for this.
Yeah, in many examples, it turns out, at least in some examples, it can happen that supersymmetry, any solution of the supersymmetric equation implies, it's also a solution of the equations of it's also a minimal surface, but not always.
Okay. Okay. Well, I should investigate that. That'd be very interesting. Yeah.
I think that this case that Charles is mentioning is precisely ADS 4 times S2, which I think is related to what you were saying. S2.
There is a paper in the literature that studies J holomorphic equations on ADS 4 times S2. It's not quite exactly what you're doing, because you're really looking, ADS 4 times S2 for you is like an auxiliary space, right? Like you have,
I don't know. It's certainly the space I'm interested in, yeah.
But But the original problem is studying with the minimal minimal surfaces in ADS4, not ADS4 times 2.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So this paper that Lucas says is a paper that studies kind of minimal surfaces and supersymmetric surfaces in ADS4 times 2.
I think I would really love to see this reference. I think it would be really, really helpful.
I mean, that I can give you in real time, even maybe. But just to be clear that for them, ADS4 times S2 is both where the minimal surface lives and where the supersymmetric surface lives.
I understand. Okay. Yeah, that's good.
And there they claim, and I'm not sure how if they've had the most general supersymmetric embeddings. That's something that I have to confess that I'm not sure if they really made some restriction. But there they do show or argue in this particular example that that the supersymmetric surfaces are minimal. But I believe that's not the case in general. Let me see. I hope I send you. How do you write it in the chat? For what? Okay. Well, here. Do you see it?
Yeah, I've got it. That's brilliant.
And look, forget about that. You're going to get lost in physics. Just look at section 3.
I okay.
Think you'll understand everything very clearly. I mean, it's quite... So, for example, I mean, if you want to, if you have a couple of minutes, we can walk through a couple of the equations. So let's say, we will see if we're talking about, if you mean the same thing as I do, by the holomorphic equation, so...
Okay, I'll definitely take a look at this, and I'll get back to you when I get stuck. My experience of reading physics papers is I get stuck quite easily.
But if you
with your help, I'll get through it.
Just look at one equation, and you'll see that if that's what you mean by J holomorphic. Look at the equation. Oh wait, so what is it? Equation 3.1, for example.
Hang on, equation 3.1.
They're indices, so you may hate it, but.
I don't mind indices. Geometric analysts are not allergic to indices. We're not like differential geometers. Wow, 3.1, okay.
So that's the J-holomorphic equation.
Right, it looks very similar to...
Yeah, I mean...
I guess it is, exactly. Apart from this K, this kappa, I don't know what the kappa is.
Put it to one.
Right, when kappa's 1, that's the J-holomorphic curve equation, exactly.
Yeah, minus 1 is the anti-holomorphic one. So yeah, put just
that's
kappa.
Right.
Yeah, so and J is a almost complex structure in the target space. Little j is a...
That's right. That's exactly J holomorphic. That's what I mean by J holomorphic. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, this is the equation. And they write this almost complex structure on ADS2 times S2. Oh, sorry, ADS4 times S2.
All right, I'd be very interested to see. Perhaps it's exactly the Eel-Salomon structure.
Well, and they write it in a way... so. That, as you know much better than me, I mean, there is an almost complex structure on the sixth sphere, right?
Yes.
And I think they essentially bootstrap it from there. Because, you know, ADS 4 times S2 is closely related to sixth sphere. You have to flip some signs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they construct the almost complex structure essentially from that. I mean, they write it very explicitly. I mean, too explicitly probably for you. Like, you look at equation 323 would be a very explicit sort of writing of the almost complex structure. It's not integrable, as in your case was not integrable either, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks very, apart from the X's, it looks very, very similar to a twister almost complex structure. Yeah.
It probably is. I mean, there are many almost complex structures on ADS4.
Yeah, and this z to the minus 2 term that's coming in is the singularity. I mean, presumably z equals naught is the boundary, right?
Yeah, it comes from that.
There's a superficially very similar formula in my paper of this almost complex structure. I mean, it's not my almost complex structure, it's Eels and Salomon's.
Apparently these guys didn't even know about this.
Sure, I mean, why would they?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's a brilliant... That's a very exciting paper for me to discover. Yeah. Thank you very much. It's very helpful.
But I'm saying that from the point of view of ADS-50, there are many more general geometric backgrounds and equations that one can write down that follow from supersymmetry.
Okay. I should look at them and see if I can...
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the thing that we're... It hasn't been formulated in this way really in the literature, so that's something that with Lucas we're trying to do, to go from these supersymmetric Bayer equations to rewrite them as kind of some kind of version of J holomorphic equations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very interesting.
And actually, I think Lucas has some general result. You can say something, look at that, that, like some constraint in general of when a J holomorphic surface is a extremum.
Yeah, there is an equation that if J satisfies this equation, then the holomorphic are minimal surface.
So that's why I was bothered by your equivalence in general. That it seems not, to be the case. I'm sure it's true in your setup. I'm not denying that. I'm saying that in a more generic setup, that's not the case.
Right. Yeah. That's totally true. It's even true in C2. If you have a holomorphic curve in C2, it's minimal. But not all minimal surfaces are holomorphic curves.
Okay. Perfect.
Yeah.
Now, I was in the context of ADS P times SQ. Kind of.
Sure. That's right. And I wonder if this constraint that you find that means that a J holomorphic curve is automatically minimal, it's like if you have a symplectic form that's compatible with your J holomorphic your J, mm-hmm. then J holomorphic curves are automatically calibrated, which implies minimal.
Uh-huh.
So that's one way to do it. That's one way to prove that submanifolds are minimal is to show that they're actually calibrated with respect to a calibration form. I don't know if these words mean anything to you.
No, they mean a lot. I mean, actually, in general, in the general case, what you find is a generalized calibration. So, which I guess means that J is not closed.
Or, mm-hmm. Omega is not closed. Yeah, that's right. Well, J and omega are the same thing. You use the metric to lift an index. Right? Yeah.
Actually, I think in this paper, their J is not. It might be the same in your analysis. I think that their J is not closed.
No, my J is closed.
Maybe it's closed, but it's not exact.
That's right. In my case, it won't be exact because there are spheres. There are J holomorphic spheres.
Yeah.
So as soon as you have a compact J holomorphic curve, it can't be exact because it has non-zero integral on these two spheres. It gives you their area.
Well, now I'm confused if it's really closed or not. But it's definitely not exact. And the fact that it's not exact is very important in the fact that the normalized area of the surface that wraps ADS and the sphere is non-zero.
Okay. Yeah.
So when J, there are other examples we want to consider when J is exact, that involve ADS times S, and when it's exact, then the area of the surface that comes from the sphere exactly cancels the area that comes from the ADS. So actually, the area is zero.
Mm.
So you get -2π +2π equals zero.
I understand. Yeah. That looks like a lot like something that happens in this paper of Ekholm and Schender that I was talking about. One of the solutions for the unknot that they have is a disk with a two-sphere bubble on it. Uh-huh. So in my picture, that would be exactly one of these two spheres that has area 2π and then this...
No, but the surface that has area zero, it's a smooth surface. It's just that you start at the boundary on a circle and then when you bring it inside, it fills the sphere and ADS at the same time. Such that it's a perfectly smooth surface.
I understand. Yeah, I understand. So if you took their singular guy and made a small deformation, it would become smooth. So I wonder if it's related to this.
Could be.
Yeah, it could well be. This is very interesting.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So if you're interested, maybe at some point, Lucas and I can send you some file that, I mean, it has equations that without all the bells and whistles that come from physics, just to see what kind of equations that we get.
That would be very interesting. I'd like that a lot. Yeah, that would be very helpful.
The other thing that we found is that usually when people, But in a sense, it's a very trivial point, but when people studied supersymmetric surfaces in the context of ADSC theory, or actually string theory in general, they were dealing with, what's the way to say it? With PDEs that were quadratic in, okay, so the point is that people were studying supersymmetric embeddings and getting a certain set of equations that look extremely nonlinear, which are, of course, are hard to study. But the point is that we found actually that these equations are completely equivalent in something called the conformal gauge. I don't know if these words mean anything to you, but essentially there's a choice of coordinates that you can do on the world sheet or on your surface, such that those equations are totally equivalent to linear equations.
Mm.
And that, these are the ones that now we have to learn how to study, essentially. I mean, I can write the equations very simple. Essentially, it's just, okay. You don't mind indices. Let me see. So,
I don't mind indices, no.
And here I'm going to choose already a complex structure on the Riemann surface. So it will be something.
Okay, I can see them. I don't recognize them though.
So dz is, I mean, you know what dz bar means?
Yeah, yeah.
X are the coordinates and EAM are the Bilbaum's. You must, I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's all good.
Gamma are the Clifford, I mean, just the Clifford gamma matrices.
Yeah, yeah.
And epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 are my spinners, like parallel spinners in 10 dimensions. And the point is that from this equation, you can derive a kind of a J holomorphic equation. Let me see if that makes sense.
Yep, schematically I follow. I don't recognize the equations though, so.
Yeah, no, I mean.
That'd be something very interesting and new, yeah.
We haven't seen them in the literature, but I mean, the closest we've seen is to realize that by moving things around, that the top equation can be written as a J holomorphic equation with some choice of reality, of choice of contour for your embedding coordinates.
Well, that could be a very useful technique. Obviously, linear equations are much easier than nonlinear ones.
Yeah, so that's why we're hopeful that this can be studied. But,
yeah, yeah. Well, if you could send me some notes on that, then I'd be very, very happy to take a look.
Here's a few days because we're still kind of. We just stumbled on this kind of more recently, so we're still kind of. I will send something when I tell you that's correct, but
that's fine. There's no hurry. I have an enormous teaching load this term, so the amount of time I can concentrate.
No, so the equations I showed you are definitely correct. The supersymmetric embedding equations, and they look very innocent, right? They look like linear equations, and so the idea here is that you make a choice of epsilon one and epsilon two. And you try to solve them. I mean, it's a system of differential equations, and then you put the boundary condition, and that's where your choice of, from the physics point of view, the choice of Wilson loop that this object is dual to enters. And so you can study equations locally. You get a system of differential equations. Actually, we've already written down the system of differential equations that you get locally. We have not completely understood then the further restriction that the boundary conditions will impose on the local system.
Mm-hmm.
Because in for the physical setup, we care about the local equation, but also about the boundary condition. Because a choice of boundary condition is like a choice of observable in the physics. So different choices of boundary conditions define different objects.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah, I think I follow you. Well, I'd be very interested to read more about it. Yeah.
Maybe for now, I mean, I think this paper is, if you look at section three of the paper I sent you, I think it will give you a flavor of at least what's going on. I mean, at least, I could be curious to know. I'm pretty sure that the J that they write is your J or whoever's J. I mean,
it certainly looks related to it. I mean, they're also doing ADS, which is
literally what they're doing is ADS for them just too, which is literally what you're doing.
Well, mine's got Riemannian signature. There's might have
Oh, no, it doesn't matter. No, no. I mean, I think they can also do Euclidean. It's true that we're really interested in, well, there's certainly exciting ideas for in the frame where the boundary is R4, not S4, but that's a small, that's probably a small detail for you too.
I mean nothing. Yeah. I mean, it's no change. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's looking like a Lobachevsky plane or the Poincaré disk. Like,
yeah, absolutely. There's the mathematically they're equivalent. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but in this paper specifically, they're looking at the Lobachevsky plane, so to speak.
Okay. I'll take a look at it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. No problem.